And now the fun part, I get to introduce our guest speaker. Rick Outzen is the publisher and owner of Pensacola Inn Weekly. His blog, Rick's Blog, has become among the most influential blogs in the state of Florida. His reporting on the Billings murders, a double homicide that garnered national attention for the Daily Beast, also got the attention of the New York Times that profiled him and his blog. He was also featured on Dateline NBC's segment on the murders, No Safe Place. Rick also covered the BP oil spill for the Daily Beast, earning international attention for unraveling the oil company's spin on the disaster. He was interviewed by MSNBC, CNN, CBC TV, and Al Jazeera English. He was the first reporter kicked out of a BP meeting, and his newspaper was the only publication on the Gulf Coast that refused to take any advertising from the British oil giant. He was a finalist for the Sunshine State Awards for investigative reporting for his coverage of the failed turnaround effort of a middle school in the Escambia County Public School District. Since 2003, Rick has been a regular contributor to Ring of Fire Radio, a radio show created by Robert Kennedy Jr. and Mike Papantonio. The show originally was broadcast on Air America and is currently nationally syndicated. His books include I'm That Guy, Collected Columns of a Southern Journalist, and the now award-winning City of Grudges, recently out and available after the service. Rick grew up in the Mississippi Delta and graduated from the University of Mississippi, magna cum laude. He and his family have lived in the Pensacola area since 1982. Please join me in welcoming Rick to the podium.
I do talk slow because I'm from Mississippi, but I'm not slow. Just let you know that. It really worked well with BP. I'll get better. It's just sort of a habit I've developed. Real news in a fake world. You know, who's the press? What's news? What's a journalist? Those are questions that we probably have discussed and debated at various times through our country's history. We know that our founding fathers believed that the press was important because we have the First Amendment. And the First Amendment reads, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But we also know that James Madison, in drafting that, he actually had another intent, and it didn't quite make it to the final draft. His draft is that people shall not be deprived or abridged of the right to speak, to write, or to publish their sentiments, that the freedom of the press, as one of the great bulwarks of liberty, shall be inviolable. Inviolable. That's how important our founders believed. But they did not believe that there was only going to be one press. They did not believe that there was just going to be one opinion. And we've over years evolved to where we don't have as much, we have fewer newspapers than we've had. We have more news outlets than we have. We have more people pretending to be news outlets than we've ever had before. But I think our founding fathers expected us to be able to discern what we read and to be able to sift through it and understand it. I grew up in Mississippi, which you can tell. Grew up in the Mississippi Delta, which is so flat that if you stand on your toes and squint and really look far in the distance, you can see the back of your head. My Greenville, Mississippi is where I was born and where I was raised. Greenville was known for two things, cotton and its daily newspaper, the Delta Democrat Times. Hiding Carter II, who I've dedicated my book after, came out of World War II and challenged segregation, challenged the state legislature. Greenville's probably only had about 20,000 people at that time. State legislature passed resolutions calling him a liar. He had to carry a gun when he walked on the streets. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorial writing. From Harding, whose grandkids, whose son and grandkids lived down the street from us, on Kirk Circle was that that newspapers mattered. That newspapers, you argued about it, you disagreed with it at times, you agreed with it sometimes, but you wanted to read it and talk about it. Hodding became sort of the voice of the New South of journalism in the 50s and 60s. So from Hodding and from his son, I grew up in a town where newspapers mattered. Then I went to Ole Miss to school because I could color. And at Ole Miss, I got to introduce to William Faulkner. He wasn't alive at the time, but his home was there, Roanoke. And at that time in the 60s and 70s, Mississippi really wasn't teaching Faulkner because they didn't want us to understand that the South was recovering still from the Civil War, that Reconstruction, battling with that, battling with race. But Faulkner was interesting in that his goal in his writing was that his words would stand the test of time, that he would so capture the human emotion that 100 years after he passed away, that those words would matter. So from Faulkner, I learned to try to make those words matter when I do write. And then that last part of influence in my life was my father, who was a master storyteller, who could tell a story. I remember I would ride with my father. He sold insurance. We would ride. And he would start with a story in the day. And every time he met with somebody, the story changed just a little bit. And I remember going home that night, and I felt really bad because I said, "Mom, Dad tells lies. You know, he keeps, you know, it's the story's not the same." So, well, you need to go talk to your father. So I sat down with my dad, and I was really, he said, "What's the matter, Rick?" And I told him, "Dad, your story kept changing. Did it get better?" It's what he asked. And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "That's what you do. That's how you tell a story, son. And you adapt it to your audience." When my father passed away, he died when he was 49 years old. The thing that I remember a lot about that day, but the thing I remember is how many people came up to us after the funeral to talk about how my father was their best friend. And my father took their, made sure that they got their life insurance policy when somebody passed away. He would come by the house and take, somebody out, looked after their son, everything that my dad did. And he taught me about how to care about everybody. So when you look at NWeekly, hopefully you see these things, that you see a newspaper that tries to matter no matter how small we are, who have the hubris to believe we do matter. You see someone when we write that we try to make the words last, that we can evoke an emotion and push change. And you see someone that fights for the little guy. This is about this time 20 years ago, I was planning to do this, to do the independent news. First issue was July 1st, 99. My hair was not gray. In fact, there was more of it. But that's because of my daughters. It has nothing to do with the newspaper. But it took us a while to figure out what our voice was. My background is a CPA. I'm not a journalist. I know 500 words. And the trick is putting those 500 words in the right order every week. If I can do that, then I got a newspaper. But I've been very fortunate to work with some very, very gifted people and to be thrown in some circumstances that have made me right above my level and become better at what I do. And I think our newspaper has been a part of helping make this a better town. We haven't always got it right. There was a time when I was a whole lot meaner than I am now. There was a time when I was a little bit smarter. But I've had really smart people around us. It's kind of hard being the old guy, writing, rather than it used to be fun to be the punk. The turning point for us was Hurricane Ivan. We woke up and realized that we depend on advertising. We have free distribution racks all over Escambia, Santa Rosa County. 75% of those businesses were gone the day we woke up after the hurricane. 75% of those businesses, our racks were gone. We had to lay off 2/3 of the staff. And we huddled both at the house and at the paper. And we made a decision that we were going to try to make it. My wife, I convinced her to let us use the credit cards for a year, which we did, which we paid off 3 years ago, barely. But we made a decision that we were gonna be, because what happened in Hurricane Ivan, which seems like yesterday, but it was 2004, was we finally saw, were exposed to what this town really was. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but what we were seeing was that during the 90s, a significant part of this town had a very good life. But there was 30 to 40% that did not have a good life. And when you saw the roofs gone, you saw the tarps, you started realizing that we have a significant poverty problem. That we just didn't want to look at that part of town. And that when we started seeing insurance companies try to renege on their deals. We saw a wastewater treatment plant downtown that overflowed into yards and houses all along the bay. We had a rebuild organization that had a great mission, had a lot of money, didn't quite like to be questioned about how they were spending the money. And we came out fighting aggressively. We made a decision that we would create this character, Rick Outson. That this town needed somebody that was willing to be the guy. And so we created this character that was willing to go to the room and say, this isn't right. That would write the editorials, that would push the envelope. And it was still touch and go. For us, try to tell real news in a fake world, in a world that did not want to hear it, was a challenge. We had a death in the jail in 2005. As Hurricane Katrina was hitting New Orleans, Robert Bogan, 65 or so year old African-American truck driver, had a mental health issue, knocked over some boxes in a Dollar General store, was arrested. Instead of taking him to Lakeview, they put him in a cell because he was incoherent. He died 10 days later, never seeing his family again. Spiraling out of control. What ended up happening was because they did not put him on his meds, his mental state digressed. They had a thing called a restraint chair, which is you're only supposed to be on it for 30 minutes if you're out of control. They restrain you. He was in a restraint chair for 4 to 5 hours a day, tasered in a shower, and died. It was one of three deaths within a two-year period. Well, actually a six-month period. The sheriff at the time did not like us reporting that story. My shareholders did not like us reporting that story. I was told to fire people. I was told to resign, and I refused. In fact, the moment that Collier Merrill likes to tell, when Collier Merrill at that time was a shareholder, he was not that fond of me either at that time. But he says, the thing that happened, Rick, that I remember always, is you finally got up and you looked at the sheriff and you said, I'll start writing better stories for you when you quit killing people. He finally did. They changed their policies. It made a difference. Same time, we started working on Community Maritime Park because we believed that that could be a difference maker. We'd looked at other towns. We'd looked at seeing how they had handled. Downtown ballparks had worked for economic development. We had seen it. Minor league baseball was on the rise. We took it on. Then we created the Pensacola Young Professionals because we felt like everybody was talking about how do we keep our young people, but there were no young people in the room because there weren't any jobs here. And we began to become the paper that people read because they could trust us. And I'm okay not being liked. I actually told people that. I would go and speak to a group. They still, you know, and I would say, it's okay. They would come, people would come up to me and say, you know, I read you all the time. I don't always agree with you. I said, that's okay. That's all right. You know, I'm all right with that. Because I think we kind of lose that, and it seems to be heightened now, but as a whole, we lose that ability to disagree. You know, I love to hear someone else's opinion. It makes me have to think more about my own. You know, we tend to do too quickly, and Pensacola was doing it long before anybody else. We get too quickly to the person rather than listening to the argument being made. And I think that somehow gets lost in the mix. And we're also in a place now where people gravitate to the news that they want to hear, that the news that agrees with them. They can be on social media. They can like their friend. They can stay within a certain circle of friends on Facebook and never hear anything that they don't want to hear. Now, of course, we've learned now that the Russians also participate in that process. But it's become an era where people are gravitating, rather than having this, you know, discussion about what the ideas are, is we gravitate, I hate this person, or I'm going to go to the place where I can get the same information all the time. And that's the part of freedom. That's the other side of freedom of the press, is you as a reader have the freedom to pick what you read, but you also have a challenge to be informed. You know, we're not perfect. Yeah, as journalists, we're not. I think we try to do the best we can. There are shady characters that there are in every profession. And we've also seen a heightened attacks on journalists. In the last year, 42 journalists have been physically attacked in this country by the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. 5 were killed this year. 4 of them in Annapolis, Maryland, in the Capital Gazette offices. Newsrooms are smaller, which makes it more judicious use of your sources. But we've also seen a renaissance of freedom of the press. I'm very, very proud of what print media is doing and what we're seeing happening. And I think part of that, it may be naive on my part, but part of it is I believe that because we've seen what has happened when you have anonymous people on Facebook, you don't know if that's a real person or a robot, that people are going back to print because at least you know who this person is. They have a body of work, you know, and you can tell that this means something. You can see their picture. You know, you see a body, you know, what they're doing. Because our role is not to be cheerleaders. You know, our role is to try to question, try to push, try to add perspective. In a small town, perspective's a big thing. Try to add perspective to the stories. Example, a few years ago, we had 6 people die in the jail within a year, a little bit over a year. And the county administrator and the county staff, their approach was, well, just people die. You know, they're sick, they die. And it just didn't set well with me. So based on the earlier reporting at another time, I said, how can I get upset over 3 but not get upset over 6? So I went out and looked, and the people that were dying in the county jail here, our county jail is not a prison. It is people waiting trial, or they've got a sentence that's less than a year. You know, parole violation or something, but it's not a maximum security prison. They go to state prison. So I looked at what the national statistics were. 90% of county jails in this country had 0 deaths in a year. We had 6. We have that 10 remaining percent, 5% had 1 death. Another 2, I mean, it was down to where the most jail deaths that they were having that was measurable in a percentage was 3. And we had 6. We were able to publish the story. They replaced the jail director. They've only had one death since then, since we told the story, and they were still working on trying to get the initiatives done to do it. So papers still can matter. I'm proud of what the news journal's doing on a lot of levels. They have stepped up their game. As you look around, there are plenty of great daily newspapers out there. So the press is not going away. We're not going to crumble. And we'll do our best as we can to constantly try to be a voice, to push for the tenets that you push for as a church, for diversity, for social justice, to help. And it's okay if you get upset with me. Thank you very much.